This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favour after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's foreign minister is visiting New Delhi to boost a long-term roadmap for cooperation. 23 million Yemenis in need of urgent assistance. Two global agencies sound the alarm over the escalating humanitarian emergencies. And also, calls are growing on the UK government to act immediately to prevent millions of people from plunging into poverty. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: in the hours ahead, Iran's foreign minister, who is in New Delhi on an official visit, will hold a series of diplomatic meetings with Indian officials. Upon arrival early today, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said joint efforts to lay out a long-term roadmap for cooperation will be the prime goal of his visit. The Iranian minister believes the current level of bilateral ties is satisfactory, but the two sides need to work closely together to go beyond that level. In the meantime, a tweet by the Indian Foreign Ministry says the top Iranian diplomat has arrived to a warm welcome, adding the visit will boost the deep historical bonds. Meetings have been scheduled with India's Prime Minister and Minister of External Affairs, as well as religious scholars and Iranian expatriates. He will next travel to the cities of Mumbai and Hyderabad. Iran is asking the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency to vote down an anti-Tehran resolution submitted by the U.S. and its three European allies, Britain, Germany, and France. The draft resolution will be put to vote at this week's meeting of the 35-member policy body, a policy-making body of the IAEA. The draft reportedly calls on Iran to fully cooperate with the agency to clarify and resolve outstanding safeguard issues. It also accuses Iran of having undeclared nuclear material at some of its sites. As the Board of Governors convened Monday, IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi also said in a press briefing that Iran's cooperation with the agency has been insufficient and inadequate. Iranian officials immediately rejected the claim, saying the country has fully cooperated with the UN nuclear watchdog.
Sampling at a couple of sites showed a very little amount of nuclear particles, Subsequently, Iran offered the required and sufficient explanations to the IAEA. Constant pressures by the U.S., some Western countries, and the Israeli regime are among the reasons why the IAEA has put the issue as a major point on its agenda. The agency has no independent role.
The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran echoed Gharib Abadi's remarks. Mohammad Islami said Iran has provided the IAEA with adequate explanations, but the agency does not have a serious will to call Tehran's response as convincing. He criticized the IAEA for relying on Israeli reports. Meantime, the European Union issued a statement at the IAEA Board of Governors. The statement voiced support for the full implementation of the 2015 Iran deal known as the JCPOA. It said the removal of anti-Iran sanctions is an essential part of the deal. The statement, however, voiced concern over what it called a series of Iranian actions inconsistent with the JCPOA. Earlier, academic and geopolitical policy advisor Alexander Ozadegan joined us to give his perspective on an anti-Iran resolution that the U.S. and its allies are pushing at the board meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Any little thing in Iran is going to be politicized, whether it was the train that got derailed from Mashhad to Yazd or the 10-story building collapsing. The enemies of Iran are going to politicize it. They're going to link it to the nuclear issue, and it's going to just go on from there and never stop. The bottom line is that sanctions are terror tools used by all imperialistic powers to destroy, sabotage, and implode the stability in other countries. It's economic terrorism is what we call it. The idea is to destroy the spirit of the people, economic coercion. Iran's case going up the chain at the IAEA level, and the accusations are serious. Of course, Iranian military facilities are not obliged to be inspected, but that's exactly the point that they're trying to make. IAEA and also the politicization by United States and E3.
Staying with Iran, at least 17 are reported dead and dozens more wounded in a train derailment in a central city just hours ago. Reports say over a dozen of those wounded are in critical condition. The incident has happened near the desert city of Tabas in South Khorasan province on the rail linking it to the central city of Yazd. Rescue teams with ambulances and helicopters have been dispatched to the area. According to the initial reports, the train carrying nearly 350 passengers collided with an excavator. Further investigation is underway to find out the exact cause of the accident. New reports are indicating that the humanitarian crisis in the war-torn Yemen is worsening. According to a report by the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, the number of people in need of humanitarian assistance has risen to more than 23 million. Over the past year, the report also says the number of Yemenis requiring food assistance has jumped to over 17 million. It has cited the ongoing war, continuing economic shocks, and decreasing aid as the reasons. Another report by the International Monetary Fund says that rising food prices and inflation worldwide amid the Ukraine war have deteriorated the crisis in Yemen. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its allies, launched a war on Yemen in 2015. It has directly or indirectly claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis. The UN has already described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UK is facing a cost of living crisis that has exacerbated already, stifling disparity and austerity. Now people are mobilizing to demand the government bail out the poor, not the rich. Bianca Raimi tells us more in this report.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country, and that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognize that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well. And we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned, and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner.
Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, national insurance contributions and tuition fees. You name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But, Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Hospitals across France were deeply impacted by a strike for medical personnel. French public health used to be ranked the best in the world, but austerity measures have caused a sharp decrease in the quality of care. Rami Mazzotti has more from Paris.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. Since the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers.
France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts.
Neoliberal economics as applied to public healthcare has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good healthcare.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Russian and Ukrainian forces are locked in an intense battle in eastern Ukraine as the war between the two neighbors grinds through its fourth month. Moscow says its troops are now in full control of residential areas in the city of Severodonetsk.
The residential areas of the city of Severodonetsk have been fully liberated. We continue to establish control over the city's industrial zone and the nearest settlements.
Fierce fighting is raging on in the streets of Severodonetsk, with the city mayor saying that the situation is changing every hour. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are outnumbered by more powerful Russian troops, but they still have a chance to fight back. He also said Ukraine will continue the fight until it takes back all its territory from Russian forces, and that stalemate is not an option. Zelensky rejected speculations that Ukraine might cede some parts of its territory to Russia to end the war. White supremacists are no longer causing trouble exclusively inside the United States. American authorities are now concerned about the battle-hardened extremists fighting in Ukraine who are set to return to their homeland. And that's particularly worrying amid the rising violent incidents inside the U.S.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia, alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's, in effect, another example of a proxy war. In this instance, between the U.S. and Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone.
The exact number of American nationals fighting in Ukraine is unknown, but a report in March estimated it to be around 3,000. The challenge they pose to Washington is twofold. First, they'll return to the U.S. with more military training, which could escalate the country's already alarming rate of domestic terror incidents. Second, they confirm the Russian notion that Moscow is fighting a war against neo-Nazis and foreign elements.
Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
The House Select Committee investigating the U.S. Capitol attack on 6th of January 2021 intends to review previously secret White House records, photographs, and videos to prove how former U.S. President Donald Trump broke the law. We have prepared for you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled U.S. Capitol attack panel to unveil new evidence against Trump at public hearings. The House Select Committee investigating the U.S. Capitol attack will unveil new evidence at Watergate-style public hearings showing that Donald Trump and his top aides acted with corrupt intent to stop Joe Biden's certification. According to sources close to the inquiry, the House panel intends to use the hearings as its principal method of revealing potential crimes by Donald Trump as he sought to overturn the 2020 election results, in what could be a treacherous legal and political moment for the former president. As the Justice Department mounts parallel investigations into the Capitol attack, the House Select Committee is hoping that the previously unseen evidence will leave an indelible mark on the American public about the extent to which Donald Trump went in trying to return himself to the Oval Office. Norman Ornstein, a political scientist and emeritus scholar at the conservative think tank the American Enterprise Institute, said of the hearings, "They're important for setting a record for posterity, but they're also important for jolting the American public into realizing what a direct threat we had coming from the highest levels of government to illegitimately install a president who had lost the election." The sources said the panel's ambitions for the hearings were twofold: presenting the basis for charging Donald Trump broke the law and placing the Capitol attack in a broader context of efforts to overturn the election, with the former president's involvement as the central thread. The sources said at their heart, the hearings are about distilling thousands of communications between top Trump White House aides and operatives outside the administration and the Trump campaign into a compelling narrative of events about the events of 6th of January. In order to tell that story, the sources said, the House Select Committee intends to have its senior investigative counsels reveal previously secret White House records, photographs and videos that will be presented in real time to starkly illustrate the live witness testimony. On Thursday night, 9th of June, at the annual hearing at 8 p.m. local time, the panel's chairman, Benny Thompson, and the vice chair, Liz Cheney, are likely to make opening arguments, outline a roadmap for the hearings, and give an overview of the events of 6th of January 2021 and the preceding weeks. The panel is likely to focus on broad themes for the following four hearings, such as how Donald Trump used false claims of voter fraud to undermine the 2020 election and future races, and how he tried to use fake electors to deceive Congress into returning him to office. House investigators are also likely to focus on how Donald Trump directly pivoted to the 6th of January congressional certification and not the December deadlines for states to certify their electors as an inflection point, and how his actions led straight to militia and far-right groups' covert maneuverings. The House panel is then likely to reserve its most explosive revelations for the final hearing in prime time, where the Select Committee members Adam Kinzinger and Elaine Luria are expected to run through Donald Trump's actions and inactions as the 6th of January attack unfolded. The sources said the list of witnesses has not yet been finalized, but it is expected to include top aides to former Vice President Mike Pence, top aides to Donald Trump's former Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, and people with direct knowledge of militia group activities on 6th of January 2021. From a legal perspective, the House panel has already charged in court filings that Donald Trump and his external legal adviser John Eastman violated multiple federal laws to overturn the 2020 election outcome, including obstruction of Congress and defrauding the United States. The sources said the Select Committee hopes that by revealing new evidence in hearings, it can convince beyond a reasonable doubt the American public and potentially the Justice Department that the former president violated laws to reverse his 2020 election defeat. Among the highlights of the already public evidence, including the revelation that John Eastman, Donald Trump's external legal adviser, admitted to Mike Pence's counsel, Greg Jacob, that his scheme to obstruct Congress on 6th of January was actually unlawful, but pressed ahead with it anyway. Meanwhile, the internal White House schedule for 6th of January that the House Select Committee obtained through the National Archives showed that Donald Trump would have known he had no plans to march with the crowd to the Capitol when he falsely promised that at the Ellipse rally. The sources said House investigators are in many ways making their case to the American public, since it is not certain the panel will make criminal referrals to federal prosecutors, given they are not binding on the Justice Department, which has the sole authority to file charges. But that quest will come with its own challenges, with the House panel's greatest difficulty in perhaps not so much whether they can show wrongdoing by Donald Trump and his top advisers, but whether it can get Republican and independent voters to care. The repeated delays in holding the hearings have meant House investigators were able to finish most of the evidence gathering they intended to conduct. The committee initially anticipated holding them sometime in the spring, then in April, and then in May, and now in June. According to two sources familiar with the inquiry, committee counsel recently told one witness, who had been assisting the investigation for months, that it didn't expect to ask for any more assistance. The counsel told that particular witness, "We are pretty much done." But the consequence of the decision to delay the start of public hearings and the constant drip of news from the investigation is that it might have driven some 6th of January fatigue, which Donald Trump's allies on Capitol Hill are intent on weaponizing to defend Trump. According to party aides, the former president's most ardent defenders in Congress and top Republicans led by the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, are planning aggressive counter-programming to the public hearings that slammed the panel as partisan. Vox earlier reported the Republican National Committee has also circulated a one-page memo of talking points requesting that Donald Trump's surrogates attack the investigation as rigged, even though multiple federal courts have ruled the inquiry is fully legitimate.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
The Russell Tribunal on Palestine. By 1948, the Zionist Agency and Haganah had drawn up a plan to drive out the Arabs by using terror to spread fear and encourage civilians to leave their homes without any resistance. The Deir Yassin massacre, which left over 100 people dead, spread panic across Palestinian villages, as the Zionists had intended, and encouraged civilians to flee their homes. Ben-Gurion declared that old Palestinians would die and the young would forget their homeland. Gurion personally directed the obliteration of the Arab past with Judaized names of streets, villages and towns and building settlements on 350 destroyed Palestinian villages. But the Palestinian people have not forgotten their Palestine and dream of returning to their homes and land one day. The question that many Palestinians ask themselves today is, has the world forgotten about Palestine and its people? Events such as the Russell Tribunal on Palestine show that the world has not forgotten Palestine or the Palestinians. The first session on Palestine took place in 2010 and was established to examine the role and complicity of third parties such as governments, institutions and corporations in violation of international law committed by Israel against the Palestinian people. Since its creation in 1966, the Russell Tribunal has sought justice when powerful countries turned a blind eye. It demanded investigations when governments tried to hide. And now, the tribunal has reached its final session on Palestine. We are back at Brussels as the jury looks back at the tribunal's work during the last 5 years. The jury is summarizing the findings of the previous sessions, from which it will draw general conclusions. The tribunal's rulings are non-binding and have little more than sentimental value. I spoke to some of the participants at the tribunal and asked why they were taking part and what they felt was the purpose of these sessions.
Monitors the situation in the Middle East. We monitor violations of human rights law and international humanitarian law. We try to mobilize public opinion to make people more aware of the violations of international law by Israel, and we try to give the general public an opportunity to express their feelings and views on the subject of Palestine. I think we all agreed that the situation in Palestine is very serious, that Israel is guilty of serious violations of international law. But the problem is that the United States and the European states are largely unconcerned about the situation in Palestine. And so the purpose of the Russell Tribunal is really to create public awareness of the situation and to try to influence public opinion. And we also call upon the United Nations and states to comply with international law.
We are trying to address a message to the public opinions in Europe, in the United States, in Arab countries as well, and ask them to push on their governments where they are to ask their governments to comply with the international law and to push Israel to comply with the international law and to sustain Palestinians to fulfill their rights, in particular the right of self-determination, which is a right which is in the chart of the United Nations.
This tribunal concerns the most critical unresolved situation of injustice on our planet. Sometimes it seems impossible of resolution, and yet I am very optimistic. Think of what has been achieved, the changes achieved in my lifetime, and indeed I think the lifetime of many in this room, too many perhaps. You know, we have to mobilize the young, as Stefan did with his books, also published in his 90s. We have seen the ending of apartheid. We have seen the ending of colonial rule in Africa. We have seen the fall of fascism in Latin America and indeed in many parts of Europe. We have seen the Berlin Wall pulled down. And these momentous changes happened because of the struggle and sacrifice of the peoples directly involved, aided by the solidarity of ordinary people and their organizations around the world. I am here because I am confident that the oppression of the Palestinian people will likewise be ended.
The tribunal has sought to galvanize international and public opinion in the hope that the international community would put pressure on Israel to cease its criminal activities and respect Palestinian sovereignty. Leila Shahid, the first Palestinian woman ambassador and the official representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization in Europe, shares her thoughts with me on the tribunal.
Of course, a tribunal of citizens. It's not an official one. But, you know, we are in the world of civil society. We have seen a revolution in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Bahrain, in Libya, in Yemen. The world is waking up. We have seen all the people who followed Stefan Essel and who made indignatos, you know, indignation in Wall Street, in Spain, in Portugal, in Greece, saying that the citizens also must have their own contribution to the implementation of civil rights, of human rights, and of international humanitarian law. So I think it has an impact because now with the new media, television, internet, the whole world knows the truth. You know, 50 years ago, when they kicked out all the Palestinians, nobody knew what happened. Now people know the truth. And I think that's very important that citizens in the world will also put pressure on their governments, on their elected member of parliament, to make Israel comply with its obligations in relation to the violation of the Palestinian people.
With the Arab Spring in full session, the Arab people are busy toppling their dictators and trying to bring democracy to their countries. Thus, for now, the plight of the Palestinian people is far from the forefront of their minds.
At the time of Barcelona session, we didn't have the Arab Spring. So the 100% of the Arabic countries were led, were ruled by dictators, in fact. People have not been chosen by their people. You know, the leaders were self-designated leaders. And I think that they wanted to keep on their thrones. And to keep on their thrones, they have to obey to the people, the states, the countries, Europe, in the United States, etc. The leaders of the European Union and in the United States ensure them to be seated, to remain seated on their thrones, and they were afraid of their own people. So they didn't have, you know, an autonomy in the decision.
The problem is, of course, there is now a great problem between some of the Arab countries, particularly the Gulf countries, and Iran, because you know that Iran is, and it's legitimate, is a power in this part of the world, like Turkey is, like Egypt is. It's normal. But the Gulf countries consider that the threat that they are facing first and foremost is from Iran. You know that there are problems between a number of Gulf countries, not only on the Persian or Arab Gulf, but also on the fact that in most of these countries there are important Shiite communities living in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait. So they have sort of put Palestine also as a second priority, not as a first priority. Then you have, of course, the Arab revolutions. You have in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, a change, a very important change of government. So also they are thinking of their own internal situation, which is legitimate, so that they are not always available to support or to be very effective in their support of Palestine. They do, of course, at the UN, and this is how we were able to get 138 countries voting in favor, because also of Arab support. But I would say this period for the Arab world is a difficult one. This is why we cannot limit the solidarity to only the Arab countries. We must make it available for all the free people in the world. You saw in this jury, there are South Africans, you have British, you have American Indians, you have Argentinians, you have French, you have Dutch, you have people from all, you have Irish, you have people who are members of a jury who represent the world community of justice and law. And I think this is why they represent also a very important consciousness of the world. You know, in struggles in the world, unfortunately, very often, the governments, the regimes, make compromises because they have interest in oil, they have interest in making alliances with Israel. But when you talk to people who are people of thought, intellectual judges, jurists, then they are the conscious of the world. And I think that Stéphane Hessel, who was the honorary president of Distributel, was the best example. But this also is an engine to make third parties in the world, citizens, parliaments, trade unions, churches, also enter the battle to force Israel to respect the Palestinian rights and to put an end to occupation and to accept the fact that the Palestinians have the right to a sovereign, independent state.
The Russell Tribunal has been more than just a simple gathering of citizens who are concerned for the Palestinian people. Far from just being an academic exercise, the tribunal has shed light on the suffering of the Palestinian people caused by the unjust criminal acts committed by Israel. But the plight of the Palestinian people remains the same, a daily struggle for survival under the rule of Israeli occupation. So how much has the tribunal actually achieved? I asked one of the main organizers of the tribunal, Frank Barrett, who has been fighting for justice for Palestine for the past decade, if the tribunal had achieved any of its goals.
I mean, we haven't achieved our goals, because our goals are, you know, justice for Palestine, freedom for Palestine, and it's not, you know, it's not happened yet. But this is a long-term goal, obviously, and what we hope the tribunal will have permitted is to create an ever bigger momentum for those goals to be realized. So when we started in Barcelona talking about EU complicity, and when we moved to London about talking about corporations, and then the UN and the US, it was all about, again, empowering us, the people of Europe, North America, people that actually don't have maybe direct links to Israel, Palestine, but to empower us and to make us understand that actually we are all linked and to what's happening on the ground, regardless of our nationality or religious beliefs, and that the situation in Palestine touches us all. We can call it, if you want, the reproduction of the occupation is happening also in various countries around the world. And most importantly, we are not passive actors. We are very active actors because our governments are complicit, because the corporations we buy mobile phones from, shoes from, are also complicit. So it's down to us to stand up to those institutions, to our states and governments, and tell them that, you know, they're not talking in our name.
The tribunal may not have had the power to liberate Palestine and free the Palestinians from a life under occupation, but they have succeeded in putting pressure on international companies complicit in the atrocities committed by the Israeli state. And in so doing, the International Campaign Body for Freedom for Palestine has become larger and more powerful.
The London session, who was focusing on companies who are involved in the occupation, produced clear conclusions condemning these companies, amongst others Dexia, based on a legal analysis of human rights violations, etc., international law, which for us was very important. Secondly, it helped us to make Dexia stop the funding of these settlements. We didn't find any new loans anymore. And so this London session was very useful for that. And just I want to add one thing. The building where we are now for the closing session of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine used to be a building of the Dexia Bank. And we were campaigning in the same room as we did now during the General Assembly. So it makes me very happy that this time, in the same building, it's not campaigning against this bank, but it's also a moment of a conclusion of a successful tribunal, which helped the solidarity movement on Palestine to make bigger networks and to make bigger pressure on companies, amongst others.
The London session of the tribunal was especially relevant to this theme of international solidarity. It was about the complicity of private corporations in Israel's violations of international law. We were hearing evidence about companies, some of them are familiar names, operating in our own countries and connected to Israel through a web of affiliates and subsidiaries. Private corporations are deeply involved in the three main areas in which international law has been violated: the building of the settlements in Jerusalem and the West Bank, the construction of the separation wall on the West Bank on Palestinian territory, and the incursion of Israeli forces into Gaza in the Operation Cast Lead, inflicting horrendous damage in December 2008 into January 2009. By way of example, and these are just examples, the British-Danish giant G4S, through its Israeli subsidiary G4S Israel, is responsible for the security operations in the military checkpoints at the wall, in the settlements, and in the prisons. The very symbols of oppression are being organized by this British-Danish company. The United States company Caterpillar has supplied the Israeli army with the bulldozers which have demolished Palestinian houses and cleared land for the construction of the wall. The French transport company, Veolia, built and operated the light rail project in occupied Jerusalem. Significantly, the tribunal wrote to all these companies, and Veolia replied, informing us that it had decided to divest its interest in that project.
The tribunal was about empowering us and make us realize that what's happening in Palestine and Israel is not a faraway conflict, but we are all active actors and we should stand up against, you know, any injustice in the world, in particular in Palestine.
We're entering a new phase at the end of the hearings, the formal hearings, a new phase, and I'm going to, in a sense, declare it as a legal intifada. A legal intifada in which all of you and all of us, whether we're in a formalized body or not, utilize the tools, utilize the international frameworks that are there to bring about change and make a difference which we know we can do. I'll illustrate how this is in that very short time frame you see up there, really, 2010 to now, barely three years. What has happened in one or two ways? And the intifada that I'm talking about is therefore that Israel is going to be faced with challenges, legal challenges, on all fronts, at all times, from all sides. And those who are imprisoned in Palestine should know that we're out there to support them, to support the rule of law.
The U.S. and the UN continue to support Israel as it commits the most awful crimes against humanity. And of course, the Russell Tribunal, in its strategies for the future, focuses a great deal on the need to utilize the UN, particularly given the fact that despite presence of Israel and the U.S. The General Assembly recently accorded Palestine non-member observer state status, which means that Palestine is now in a position, and we support the Palestinians who are calling for this, to join the International Criminal Court, and it can demand standing to bring charges against Israel.
Frank Barrett further explains what conclusion the jury had reached.
As the jury just said, the tribunal in itself, in terms of having sessions every year, is over. We feel we have addressed, you know, the topics we wanted to address. The complicities of various third parties have been thoroughly addressed. We've established that legally we could call Israel an apartheid state. So for us, this is now a time for, we've got the basis, we've got the law on our side, how to implement it, how to make sure people around the world make the findings of the tribunal their findings, then, you know, talk to their governments about it, talk to their families about it, talk to their bosses about it. And so, yeah, the next few months, there's going to be a lot of work in terms of follow-up, going to various countries, going to various solidarity groups, having meetings with them, a brainstorm with them, to try to see how we, as an internationalist movement, if you know what I mean, can make sure justice in Palestine is happened.
We had witness. We had the legal context provided, explaining the Palestinian right to self-determination, nature of this denial by Israel, its relation to apartheid and persecution, the prohibition of apartheid in international law, the law and practice of apartheid in South Africa, as well as an overview of Israeli law and policy with respect to the prohibition of apartheid. These experts defined apartheid relating to the status of racial groups under international law, Palestinian identity and the notion of racial domination, the notion of apartheid as an institutional regime of systematic domination, such as Israel's treatment of the Palestinians.
Of course, we who live in the United States have a very special responsibility to bring pressure on the U.S. government, including President Obama, incorporation of the progressive desires of the planet. And of course, it was important that we were able to elect him president and re-elect him. But now is the time to pressure him to cease his support of Israel and the awful crimes against humanity that it continues to commit.
United States must accept responsibility for the continued expansion of settlements and for allowing Israel to build a colonial empire and to practice apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territory.
This was the one thing Israel did not want. This is the one thing that's now in place. And if you, the Palestinian Authority, do not use the opportunity to go to the court and essentially put Israel on trial for all those things that are mapped out in our various documents, then it is a betrayal. And so therefore we say in no uncertain terms, here we go, Intifada, legal. Thank you.
There you have it. This is the end of the tribunal, but certainly not the end of the struggle, the fight, the campaigning, or the solidarity. In its closing session, the tribunal encouraged people to visit Palestine to witness the daily lives of the Palestinians and agreed a future plan forward, a future that includes an independent, sovereign Palestinian state, free from the shackles of Israeli occupation, and with the Palestinian refugees back in the homes they fled 65 years ago.
in the limelight.
What is happening in Masaf area, Tom, is not only the largest ethnic cleansing scheme to be carried out by the fake regime of Israel since 1967, but the move should be considered a first step in a much larger scheme of illegal land appropriation, ethnic cleansing, and official mass annexation. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ramzi Barud, journalist. This article is published under the heading The Ethnic Cleansing of Masaf Eryata, Israeli Regime's New Annexation Strategy in Palestine. Here's more. The Zionist regime Supreme Court has decided that the Palestinian region of Masaf Eryata, located in the southern hills of Al-Khalil, is to be entirely appropriated by the Israeli regime's military, and that a population of over 1,000 Palestinians is to be expelled. The Zionist regime's court decision on May 4th was hardly shocking. The Zionist regime's military occupation does not only consist of troops with guns, but elaborate political, military, economic, and legal structures dedicated to the expansion of the illegal Jewish settlements and the slow, and sometimes not so slow, expulsion of the Palestinians. When Palestinians state that the Nakba or catastrophe which led to the ethnic